Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio's 45 North. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Errol Morris is back in Wisconsin this week, the place where he went to college and had some early filmmaking adventures. He's getting an honorary degree from the UW-Madison, so he's been walking around reminiscing a little bit, and he's here visiting with us in this hour. Errol Morris is a legendary documentary filmmaker and increasingly a writer. You, I know, remember his 1988 film, The Thin Blue Line. It's a movie that overturned a murder conviction, freed an innocent man from jail. And The Fog of War, that was about Vietnam-era Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. That one won the 2003 Academy Award for Best Documentary. But there have been many other films, and two recent books, A Wilderness of Error is just out, I think, and a new film due out later this year about Donald Rumsfeld, who was Pentagon chief under George W. Bush. Errol, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Pentagon chief under two presidents, Gerald Ford and George W. Bush.
I know he was, I think, what, both the youngest and the oldest Secretary of Defense we've ever had.
You are correct.
I think everyone who loved The Fog of War is, of course, dying to see and curious about the new movie. It's called, I can never get this right, The Known Unknown or The Unknown Known?
Well, there are four permutations and combinations, the known known, the known unknown, the unknown unknown, and then the fourth, which is perhaps the most puzzling of all, is The Unknown Known.
This is all from something Rumsfeld himself famously said in a press conference?
Absolutely correct.
And so what made you want to make a film about Rumsfeld?
Maybe that desire for the match set, the salt and pepper shakers to secretaries of defense. The main reason is my fascination with war. And both of these secretaries presided over major wars in American history. Robert McNamara, the war in Vietnam, Donald Rumsfeld, two wars, one in Afghanistan, the other in Iraq.
And Rumsfeld, of course, was Secretary of Defense and maybe pushed out after the Abu Ghraib incidents.
Long after them, pushed out in 2006. Abu Ghraib goes back to 2004.
So it's not, I mean, of course, all wars are terrible, but those wars in particular were the focus of an enormous amount of debate over whether the U.S. had behaved as a war criminal nation.
They were the focus of enormous amounts of discussion, argument, debate. And I believe they will continue to be the focus of such debates for years to come.
Was it hard to persuade Rumsfeld to be interviewed by you?
I'm surprised he agreed to do it. I was told by a whole number of people, well, there's no way that he will possibly agree to make a film with you. But I wrote a nice letter, and I went to see him in Washington at his offices. We talked for close to 4 hours in that first meeting, and we figured out a way that we could possibly work together. And in the end, I did some 30-plus hours of interviews with him.
What did you say when you first met him? I mean, how did you explain what you were going to want to do with him?
I never know what I'm going to do with anything. I hope I'm not being disingenuous here. I've often felt about interviews that if you know all of the questions that you're going to ask and you know what the answers are going to be, why bother? Go home early. Interviews, to me, should be investigative. You shouldn't know the answers you're going to hear or the questions that you're going to ask. All I know is that I wanted to do these interviews. I wanted to make this film. But not much more.
But I'm so curious about what, because he would have known going in. Of course, he would have seen the fog of war, and anybody who saw the fog of war knows that you were doing interviews that were not just kind of straight historical interviews. You were, you take it to a place where you're sort of delving into somebody's soul and moral conscience, and you're asking them to look back and make sense of both their own lives and enormous events they participated in. So Rumsfeld would have known that any interviews with you were going to go head toward that kind of deeper territory. Do you think he's ready to do that?
One thing that I believe, I shouldn't really speak for him, but that he liked going into this project. We're all familiar with a certain kind of journalism where you get people of opposing views to sit and argue with each other. It's dramatic. Or the interviewer starts arguing with the person that they're interviewing. It's a kind of journalistic drama. Well, I like breaking the rules. I think I have been breaking the rules ever since I started making films. And part of it is trying to figure out new ways of telling a story or different ways of telling a story. The McNamara film was very unusual, Fog of War, because I only interviewed one person. So no one else in the film commenting on whether McNamara is a good person or a bad person. There's just McNamara essentially talking about himself. Of course, there's a lot of historical material that is included. And I often thought while I was editing the film that I had two McNamaras, a 40-year-old and an 80-year-old McNamara, arguing with each other throughout the film. Donald Rumsfeld, I believe, and again, I shouldn't speak for him, liked this idea that he was the person telling the story, the sole person telling the story. And although he gave me editorial control over the movie, we agreed at the outset that I was not interviewing anyone else. Actually, I did interview one other person who was in the studio, and that was his wife. And he really wanted me to interview her. She will most likely not be in the film, but it was a terrific, absolutely terrific interview.
When will the movie be out?
In the fall.
In the fall, yeah. So I was thinking about, in the Fog of War, one of the, and really in all of your movies, that thing you just talked about, that you felt like there were two McNamaras you were talking to, the young McNamara and the old McNamara. And that speaks to one of the, I mean, all your movies, I think, essentially underneath are kind of about the interior aspects of the human condition. You know, the ways in which we're all multiple people and the ways in which those multiple people inside ourselves lie to each other back and forth, the ways we deceive ourselves back and forth. Is this a fair kind of reading of one of the things that's captivated you for years?
It's a fabulous way of describing what I do. Thank you.
So I'm curious about, so many things, but the notion that that we all lie to each other all the time, how far back, how did you get interested in that subject? How far back does it go?
It probably goes back far back as I can remember. Obsession with truth. And the flip side, of course, is obsession with how people avoid the truth. Perhaps even more interesting, the latter question than the former.
You worked as a private investigator for a while early in your career, didn't you?
I did indeed.
What did you do?
I had two stints of private investigation, before I became a filmmaker, and then I made a couple of films, and then no one wanted to give me money to continue working as a filmmaker, and then I went back to private detective work. A lot of Wall Street cases.
You were ahead of your time.
maybe. I was fortunate to work for one of the very best private detectives in America. And I got to do really amazing things involving securities fraud, you name it. Often I would look at the front page of the financial section of the New York Times, and usually there'd be one, maybe even two articles of stuff that I was involved with in some way or another.
Oh, that's fascinating. So was this all sitting in rooms and paging through pages and pages of printouts and numbers and accounts, or was it following people on the street?
Well, the thing about detective work, even this kind of detective work that I was doing, it's all of the above. It's sitting in file rooms, opening file drawers, going through one manila folder after another. It's following people. It's wearing wires and recording conversations. It's interviews. I was involved in trying to track stolen money, which we believe had been transported out of the United States in the form of diamonds. So I posed as a diamond buyer in the Diamond District of New York. Really good stories, actually. I should write them up someday.
Yes, you should. They're great. What happened when you did the diamond buy? Were you worried they'd suspect or they'd know you weren't really a diamond buyer?
No. I, in this instance, was posing as myself. I didn't have a fake identity or a fake name. I was just in there buying diamonds. And you want a fast story here?
Yes.
He was trying to close the deal. I was interested in $1 million of 1-carat deflawless diamonds. This is in an office building, 47th Street. I've gone through two massive bank vault doors. The diamonds are on the table. And he looks at me and he says, "Errol, you're a Jew." And I said, "Yes. Yes, I'm a Jew." He said, "Well, there's one thing that every Jew should know. There's going to come a time when you're going to have to run. And one thing's for sure, Errol, you can't run with an apartment building tied to your back." Now, I always had this picture of a lot of Hasidic Jews humping apartment buildings over the George Washington Bridge. But the point was taken.
Did you wind up solving that case? Was he convicted, or were the diamond, smugglers caught?
Often, this is something really interesting about private detective work. Often the goal isn't to solve the case. Often you're there to serve notice to the other side that you are watching them, you are investigating them, you are looking at them. And in every investigation like that, there's a point where your employer says, "Okay, done. We're not paying you anymore. We're moving on to the next case." I made the Thin Blue Line immediately after this stint as a financial private detective in Manhattan. 2.5 years of investigating a murder, the murder of a Dallas police officer, which I... Am I boasting here? I don't think so.
No, and you're allowed to. Go ahead.
I solved. I cracked the case.
Yeah.
I got the real killer to confess. The guy who was unjustly, unfairly, wrongfully convicted, sentenced to death for a murder he didn't commit, was sprung from prison on the basis of evidence that I uncovered. But here's the difference. When you're working for someone as a private detective, there'll be a time to stop. When you're working for yourself, you can drive yourself crazy with a case because there's no one there save for yourself to tell you maybe it's time to quit this one.
Though I was thinking the parallels to filmmaking are really wonderful in the sense that you said sometimes the purpose is simply to let people know that someone's watching. Isn't in some ways that's also the gift of what you're doing with Fog of War and the Rumsfeld film. Somebody needs to hold public figures accountable just to let them know someone is watching. Yes, we are still watching. You can't watch all of them, but
maybe that's one of the primary purposes of journalism. It's not just accountability, that's part of it certainly, but that someone out there is paying attention.
Yes.
Hello there. I'm right, here.
Right. Sort of speaking. It's not so much speaking truth to power as, yes, just letting power know that there's people are watching, that we're paying attention.
It's saying something rather than nothing to power.
We're going to take a really quick break. This is 45 North, and we're talking with the legendary Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Errol Morris, maker of The Thin Blue Line and The Fog of War and a lot of other films, has a new book out called A Wilderness of Error. We'll talk about that in just a minute. You are listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with the filmmaker Errol Morris this hour. And Errol, I want to talk more about truth and lies, but there's actually, first, there's a story I wanted to ask you, because here you are back in Wisconsin where you went to college. And I read this fascinating story recently that I hadn't known about you, that there was a time when you were in Wisconsin and you and Werner Herzog went hunting for, you were thinking of making a movie about the Wisconsin's famous serial killer, Ed Gein. And you guys actually went to Plainfield, Wisconsin, thinking you'd maybe dig up his mother's grave?
Much worse than that. I lived in Plainfield, Wisconsin. I was writing a book, still unfinished, about a whole series of murders that had occurred in central Wisconsin. Murderers from central Wisconsin, Ed Gein being one of them. I think I'm one of the very, very few people. In fact, I don't know anybody else outside of various lawyers and psychiatrists who have ever interviewed Ed Gein. But I interviewed him many, many, many years ago. It's like a joke. It's the kind of name you would see in a horror film, Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
It does sound straight out of, what was the Rod Serling series?
The Twilight Zone.
Yes, it does.
Waupun, Wisconsin, and I spent a number of afternoons with Ed Gein.
My God, so more than one. What was he like?
A nice guy. Charming, soft-spoken. We never really got around to talking about the crimes themselves.
What did you talk about?
I talked about whatever he wanted to talk about. He was absolutely obsessed with Freud. Aren't we all? and he would tell me all of these stories about Freud. I assume everybody in Wisconsin knows who Ed Gein is, but so many years have passed now. Yeah.
It's probably not safe to assume, and I don't know. I don't remember all the details. I just know he's a very famous serial killer.
You don't want to remember all the details.
No,
you would have sleepless nights.
So remind us, what did Ed Gein do?
Ed Gein lived Plainfield, Wisconsin, Washara County. Not really in the town itself, a farm to the west of town. He became one of the truly notorious killers in American history, not just simply for the murders, but for a number of related crimes. He was a grave robber, a human taxidermist, a necrophile.
Human taxidermist. What did he do with human bodies?
He made things. He made furniture.
Out of human bodies?
Is this what you really want on this program?
No. No, but let's get, actually, because I'm getting distracted in the details, and what I want is the story of how did you and Werner Herzog wind up thinking you were going to dig up Ed Gein's mother's grave?
I had been living with Ed Gein's next-door neighbors. They had moved from Plainfield to just south of Plainfield to Hancock, Wisconsin. And Werner came to visit me. I had been living part-time in central Wisconsin, part-time in Madison. And he had become fascinated with Ed Gein and the question of whether Ed Gein had, say he robbed 7, 8, 9 graves. I had discovered that the graves made a perfect circle around his mother's grave.
Ooh.
And
Freudian.
My curiosity, because in the reports it was never clear whether his mother, along with these other women, had actually been taken from the cemetery.
So you wanted to know if he dug up his mother as well?
There you go.
Somehow I feel like there's more to that story, but anyway, you never did wind up making a film, though.
I should make the film eventually. I keep thinking about it. I'm tired of documentaries, to tell you the truth. I've just done too many of them, been there, done that, and the next films that I'm planning are non-documentaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been writing lately. You have this new book out. We should mention this is another investigation, but not on a film this time, and another guy accused of murder, Jeffrey McDonald.
Yes.
Yeah, what's that story?
A story that goes back to 1970, a Green Beret doctor, young Green Beret doctor, 27 years old, who was accused of having murdered his family, his wife and two young daughters. One of the most tangled, tortured cases in American history. I think I would go so far as to say that.
It was a celebrated case in the 70s, right?
It was a celebrated case. It has produced so many articles, so many books.
Well, including the famous Janet Malcolm book. Was it The Journalist and the Detective?
The Journalist and the Murderer.
And the Murderer. That's
yes.
Right.
Every detective dreams of cracking a difficult case. Isn't that really what it's all about, ultimately? But what happens when you can't crack a case? What happens when you're just basically cracking your head against a cinder block wall? The McDonald case has fascinated me for decades.
Because you thought he didn't do it?
Because I believed that he didn't do it. And even beyond that, I like to think I'm not a perfectly rational human being, but I like to think that part of me is rational. I felt that the evidence did not warrant a conviction. There was still a deep mystery about what happened in the house that night. I wanted to investigate because I wanted to understand not simply, okay, this is part of my shtick. And you nailed it just earlier in our conversation. I wanted to try to crack the case to be sure. I wanted to be able to say to myself, I know he didn't do it, or I know he did do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also am really fascinated about how we propagate error how we come to believe false things, and how we stick with those false beliefs no matter what. Once convinced that we know the truth, even if it isn't the truth, even smacking us upside the head with a 2x4 isn't going to change much of anything.
Well, that's a nice segue to, you wrote this series of pieces recently in The New Yorker about a neurological problem. I wrote it down, but I don't think I know how to say it.
Anosognosia?
There you go.
The anosognosiac's dilemma?
Yes. So anosognosia is, if I'm getting this right, you tell me, it's a neurological problem. You'd better explain it.
It's a neurological problem that prevents you from knowing that you have that neurological problem. I was writing about something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where these two scientists had done an elaborate series of social science experiments about, if you're incompetent, you're usually too incompetent to know how incompetent you really are. That incompetence prevents you from an awareness of
your
incompetence.
Incompetence.
The Dunning-Kruger effect. What a wonderful effect. And they called it a kind of social anosognosia, a comparison with the neurological version. And yes, I wrote a whole 5-part essay on this.
Yeah, well, there was a one of those essays, you talk about this episode in American history, which is fascinating for the way, as an illustration of the way in which delusions can have momentous, pivotal consequences. So this is the
Tell me about it.
So this is the episode in which Woodrow Wilson, who is the great proponent of the League of Nations, has a stroke. And what is it, for weeks, somehow the American public isn't told. But you tell this story because it's fascinating.
Well, how many instances are there in American history where the president's wife really ran the country? I can think of
one or two, three.
And this may well have been one of them. Wilson, of course, is this curious figure because he promised the world everything. He promised the world the war to end all wars, namely World War I. And if memory serves me correctly, it was not.
Didn't work out that way.
The war to end all wars. It most certainly did not work out that way.
But there are people who think that if the League of Nations plan had worked out differently, possibly World War II might not have happened.
There's that wide, strange world of counterfactuals, things that might have happened, could have happened, should have happened, but didn't. It's interesting, in these two movies that I've made, really they are movies about war, The Fog of War, and now my forthcoming movie this fall, The Unknown Known. Again, about war and how we stumble into it for reasons often that can't be reconstructed, that aren't rational. There was a screening of The Fog of War here at the University of Wisconsin campus last night, and I didn't watch the whole thing. I've seen it too many times, but I came in at the end. One of the most striking things about that story is that McNamara saw himself as a supremely rational man. That the problems of the world could be solved with rationality. And at the very end of the movie, he tells us, and it's one of the really sad lines that I've ever put on film. He says, "Rationality will not save us." It's this idea that somehow there are forces beyond our ken, forces beyond our control, that somehow drag us into conflict.
There's that moment in the film. Actually, you know what? I think we've got it queued up. This is when he's talking about the decision to bomb after the Gulf of Tonkin torpedo attacks. Let's play this clip.
August 2nd, the destroyer Maddox reported it was attacked by a North Vietnamese patrol boat. It was an act of aggression against us. We were in international waters. I sent officials from the Defense Department out, and we recovered pieces of North Vietnamese shells that were clearly identified as North Vietnamese shells from the deck of the Maddox. So there was no question in my mind that it had occurred. But in any event, we didn't respond. Two days later, the Maddox and the Turner Joy, two destroyers, reported they were attacked.
Where are these torpedoes coming from? Well, we don't know. Presumably from these unidentified craft.
There were sonar soundings. Torpedoes had been detected. Other indications of attack from patrol boats. We spent about 10 hours that day trying to find out what in the hell had happened. At one point, the commander of the ship said, "We're not certain of the attack." Another point, they said, "Yes, we're absolutely positive." And then finally, late in the day, Admiral Sharp said, "Yes, we're certain it happened." So I reported this to Johnson, and as a result, there were bombing attacks on targets in North Vietnam. Johnson said, "We may have to escalate. I'm not going to do it without congressional authority." And he put forward a resolution, the language of which gave complete authority to the president to take the nation to war. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution. Now, let me go back to the August 4th attack.
So what's the story that he actually told you then?
What's so interesting about this is that I'm struck just listening to it here in the studio. We went to war on the basis of something that never happened. We later learned that that second attack in the Gulf of Tonkin did not occur. If you like, it's the WMDs of 40 years before Iraq.
Well, that's what's so chilling, is that it's not just once. I mean, this has happened again and again and again in human history.
Indeed it has. The historian Barbara Tuchman wrote a very eloquent book, The March of Folly, of why societies do things against their best interests. Why do they engage in behavior that, politely put, makes no sense?
But I think, I'm thinking of Hannah Arendt and her concept of the banality of evil, and in a way, what you're interested in, or what we're talking about, is sort of the banality of the accidental reasons we go to war. You know, it's not as though people all planned or knew even that this was going to be the pivotal moment. They got some information. They made a few mistakes. It was probably accidents and errors that kind of compounded from one person to another as they passed bits of information down a chain. But the result was a war that killed hundreds of thousands of people.
In the case of Vietnam, 58,000 American servicemen and literally millions of Vietnamese.
So I think that what it seems to me that one of the things that, and you should tell me, fascinates you is that chain of deception, those lies.
I'm not sure that I would even call them lies. Part of what I try to do, either successfully or unsuccessfully, you have to tell me, is to chronicle these stories. Vietnam is a very powerful story. I'm still writing about it. I'm finishing another 5-part essay for the New York Times about 1965 and 1966 and the very beginnings of not the war, but our serious escalation of the war. It's odd being back here on the University of Wisconsin campus because I hope this has not been forgotten. The anti-war movement, the movement against the war in Vietnam, was very prominent on this campus. I demonstrated against the war. I was tear gassed on Bascom Hill. I was actually in an apartment on Langdon Street the night that they blew up
the Army Math Research Building.
Yes. It's all unanswerable. What do you do when your country is engaged in policies which you feel not just are wrong, but they're driving you crazy? You know, I don't think that violence is the answer. You know, the way to deal with violence isn't more violence. But these two episodes in American history are so much part of my life. I showed an early version of The Unknown Known to a small audience, and they asked me, well, why are you interested in Vietnam? Rumsfeld was in the Oval Office with President Gerald Ford when the war in Vietnam came to an end. And I said, I'm interested in the war in Vietnam because you may be in your 30s, you may not remember it, but I do, and it's very much a part of my life.
Going back to this issue I keep circling around to, the whole self-deception thing, I mean, I guess one of the questions is, it's one thing when your country is doing something, the people in power are doing something, and you can stand up and say, no, I disagree. But increasingly, it seems like we wind up with situations where you get two different politicians standing there. They're both telling you something, and they both completely agree. They don't agree. Somebody must be lying. Somebody's not telling the truth. And increasingly, the public is left not knowing. You know, there's this sort of, sorry, I don't know where I'm going with that. But the question has to do with...
Public discourse has been so contentious. It's a really strange time in journalism and in history because of the existence of the internet, among other things, that's been thrown open to such a wide diversity of people around the world, by the way, which I think is a good thing. Being a populist at heart, I think it's great that everyone in principle today can be a journalist. There's this idea, everyone's familiar with it, the marketplace of ideas. Somehow, if everybody is allowed to chatter away unendingly, that the truth will out.
Right, this idea that we live in an increasingly transparent society. And
this is something I don't agree with. The truth doesn't magically appear for any of us. The marketplace of ideas, thank you, Adam Smith, doesn't produce truth. But it's the job of all of us, journalists, historians, investigators, you name it, is to pursue the truth. The truth is outside of us and beyond us. We may never be able to grab a hold of it, but we search for it. We try to find out what is true and what is false to the best of our abilities.
Well, thank you. It's a great place to leave it. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Errol Morris, legendary filmmaker. He is the creator of The Thin Blue Line, The Fog of War won the Academy Award in 2003. Watch in the fall for his forthcoming film about Donald Rumsfeld. He's also got a couple of recent books out. He writes for the New York Times. A Wilderness of Error is the new book about the Jeffrey McDonald trial that we talked about. Errol, thanks again for being with us today. It's been great. Welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you for having me here.
You're listening to 45 North. I'm Ann Strange-Shamps. And if we've gotten you in a documentary kind of mood, what to watch next? We've got our own in-house documentary critic here, Charles Monroe
Hello.
Kane, my colleague on Wisconsin Public Radio's weekend interview show, to the best of our knowledge, and the original host of WPT's Director's Cut. Charles, what have you got for us?
Oh my gosh, I have a bunch of exciting stuff for you. But the main one is, first I want to mention that these aren't obscure reviews. These are reviews where you can get on Netflix, get on DVD today. So I want to make sure it's like
Thank
normal,
you.
Not some weird review. The main one, which everyone should watch, everyone, is called Searching for Sugar Man. And there's two reasons you should watch it. One, it came out this week on Netflix. You can watch it. And it won the Academy Award for Best Documentary of the Year. So and I'll just tell you about it. It's absolutely amazing. In the 1960s in Detroit, there was this Latino folk singer. He was the man. And but he was never really popular in America, kind of went into obscurity, ends up doing demolition in Detroit, hard labor. No one knows anything about him. But one of his albums makes it to South Africa, which is, you know, in apartheid. And it becomes like the music of whites in South Africa who are against apartheid. And he becomes huge there. But of course, he has no idea that he's huge in
but
South
nobody
Africa.
Nobody here knows.
Nobody here. And he doesn't know. That's important. And he quits playing. He's completely like doing demolition. And then just a couple of years ago, the rumor through South Africa was he died and he committed suicide on stage, very romantic. So a couple of filmmakers were like, oh my God, I loved this guy, right? Let's go find out who he is. And they went through lyrics to figure out maybe, they didn't even know he was from Detroit, figure out where he's from, and let's do a little biopic about him. And then what do they do when they get there? They find him. They had no idea they're going to find him. So I'm going to ruin more of the story, but it is beautiful. And I'll mention, it's one of the things that documentaries do that you can't do with fiction, because I think if that was the story for a fiction film, it'd be like, you know, whatever. But like, it's real. I don't know. There's something powerful about it. It's a very good film.
Well, we've got a clip queued up. Let's
yeah.
hear a bit of it.
If ever there is an air of intrigue and mystery around a pop artist, it is around the artist known as Rodriguez.
We thought he was like the inner city poet.
He was this wandering spirit around the city.
He's like a wise man, a prophet.
How many records do you think he sold in America?
In America, six.
Born in the troubled city.
Well, it's still a bit of a mystery how the first copy of Cold Fact actually came to South Africa, but it spread very quickly. To many of us South Africans, he was the soundtrack to our lives.
Everybody I knew had his records.
The message it had was be anti-establishment. Really, the first opposition to apartheid, they'll tell you that they were influenced by Rodriguez.
But nobody knew anything about him. He was a mystery.
Then we found out that he had committed suicide.
And a lot of people have different versions of the story.
He set himself alight on stage.
He reached down and pulled up a gun. I thought it'd make a good story. Find out how Rodriguez died.
There was nothing on the record to tell us who he was or where he was from. So we started looking quite deeply at the lyrics.
I met a girl in Dearborn.
We found him, we found him.
These are the days of miracles and wonder.
I heard he did like a little construction work.
He was really doing the work that no one else wanted to do. Rich in a lot of things, but perhaps not material things.
I said, in South Africa, you are more popular than Elvis Presley.
Next day, he says, Emerson, I got to go on tour. I said, why is that, Rodriguez?
This is really going to be Rodriguez. We'll only know if we can actually sing these songs.
And the one thing I was just saying while we were listening to that is that I was just so intrigued by just some clips in the film that I bought, not the soundtrack, which was good, but I bought the original album that he made that went into obscurity. It literally sold like 40 copies in America.
I was going to ask you, because listening to that, I thought, oh my God, that's a gorgeous voice. That's great. I want that music.
So just you go. You can buy the original now. It's been remastered. You can buy it on it digitally, and you get the soundtrack to the film, which is more like a greatest hits. But the original album, like, it's, and a lot of people are buying it. And like, and good for him. You know, I don't want to ruin too much of the film, but it's pretty amazing story. And it's not one of these like he died alcoholic. I hate that stuff. Like, this is people are good. People can go, well, another film I want to talk about since it's out also this week, and this one blew me away, and I just want to do a caveat before I say this, is that I don't like Michael Jackson. I don't even know why I'm saying that, but you'll find a second. I just don't like him at all. I hate his music. I think he's probably not a very nice person, and I don't really like him.
I warn you, I've said that myself before. Those are fighting words.
Uh-oh, okay.
You get bad. No, I mean...
You and I aren't going to fight. We both don't like
No, but I've said that, and it has...
Anyway, we got problems in the hallway.
There have been bad consequences.
Mm-hmm. Oh, bad. That's a good segue, because the name of the film that is made by Spike Lee, with some edits by Martin Scorsese, come some obscure filmmakers you've probably never heard of, Spike Lee and Martin Scorsese, made a film called Bad 25 as a Thanksgiving special for ABC that aired this year at Thanksgiving, a two-hour commercial-free special called Bad 25, and it is one of the best music biopics I've ever seen in my life.
Okay, I completely missed that.
Well, who would? I mean, how, like,
I
Spike
guess Thanksgiving
Lee made
it. I wasn't watching Spike, television.
But anyway, they just put it out. It's out now. You can watch it on Netflix. It's free. You
what
can
watch makes it good?
Well, one, Spike Lee and Martin Scorsese are probably the two greatest filmmakers alive.
Okay, well,
today.
What do they do as filmmakers that makes this a great...
They skipped the, hey, this is a famous person, stupid thing, behind the scenes, MTV, horrible music documentaries. And they talk about The Muse with Michael Jackson.
The Muse?
Yeah. And Michael Jackson is normal. He's like sitting there with a t-shirt on, talking about like, hey, The Muse, she descendeth like 2 months ago. This is just hard work. You know, like, and then you got Quincy Jones in there and saying, and just... It's amazing. And also, that original Bad video, that amazing video, was made by Martin Scorsese as well, which I didn't know that either. And it's good. And the point I bring it up is that, you know, Searching for Sugar Man, Bad 25, there's another films out that are these biopics about musicians. In the past, those were terrible. They were on VH1, behind the scenes, and they were stupid. They were for fans of the genre. So if you don't like Guns N' Roses, why would you watch the Appetite for Destruction documentary? These, it doesn't matter if you're a fan of Michael Jackson. It's about a human being. It's about creativity. It's beautiful.
And it's a way to combine both music and story, I suppose. Sounds like a perfect thing to curl up with on a Saturday
and a perfect
night.
Thing for a filmmaker. So what you do is you're between great Academy Award winning films. You're like, I don't know what I want to do. Oh, it's Michael Jackson 25th anniversary. You and Quincy Jones are having a cocktail. So I'll make a film. And then you make a good one. And so it's a very surprising film. I would encourage all the techno, heavy metal people who hate Michael Jackson to check it out, because it's pretty interesting.
So do you mostly watch brand new documentaries? I know you watch a lot of documentaries.
I watch a lot of documentaries.
Are you mostly watching new stuff, or do you ever go back and...
No, I'm trying to catch...
Like
I'm
older things.
I'm trying to catch up all the time. You know, I'll hear about a documentary, and I try to stay away from these, like, polemic political films, like food, something, you know, like, oh, you just know, I already agree, yeah, we don't grow enough food in urban, blah, 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 I don't want to watch it, you know, and like, or you'll have some film about Bob Marley, and you're like, oh, you know, whatever, yeah, he's great, who cares, so, like, so I try to watch films that aren't crappy.
It's
like
a good thing we're not taking calls this hour.
Yeah, what do you think? I like Bob Marley, I'm just saying you don't want to watch a terrible film about him. And so I try to find, and you'll find obscure films. Documentaries are good things to search for and have fun with. And so for me, I try to do that. But yes, I try to watch the newer ones.
So
for
pick
example,
one old one that you absolutely adore that people should see.
Okay. And this is, first, I'm not going to pick my favorite one, which is Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, made by Errol Morris, because I don't want to too much with him. That is the greatest film ever made. The second favorite film I have is called Genghis Blues. It was made in 1999. It just never went anywhere. It's about a man. He was a songwriter. He wrote that famous song, Big Old Jet Airliner, that was famous for Steve Miller Band. And he had mental illness. He's blind. He has diabetes. He ended up homeless on the streets of San Francisco. And he had a shortwave radio. He'd listen to the shortwave radio. And he heard a Tuvan station. Tuva, that's a little country between Mongolia. And I never heard of it. A Tuva between Mongolia and Russia. I mean, China. And he... learned their language. They're the throat singers. We all know
the people who do that.
Kind of throat
there
singing.
You go.
He discovered it, trained himself to do the throat singing, met the prince of freaking Tuva, and then after meeting the prince of Tuva, the prince invites him back to the country of Tuva, where he participates in the 10th, every 10 years they have a big Tuvan throat singing contest, and he participates in it. And all the while, two young kids, college students, with cameras, follow this homeless guy the whole way. It is beautiful. Your spirit changes when you watch that film. You don't get that with fiction. I like fiction, but with nonfiction, you can get some spirit-changing stuff. That man will lift your spirits. It's pretty good stuff. That Genghis Blues. Rent that movie. Get some popcorn. It's a date night movie. You'll love it.
Okay.
Better than Jennifer Lawrence. Sorry, Jennifer.
Charles Monroe Kane. He's to best of our knowledge producer and national marketing director, original host of Wisconsin Public Television's Director's Cut. We'll post Charles's DVD watch list for this weekend on our Facebook page. Don't go away. We've got another hour of 45 North ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sugar! Illuminate your dream! Experience America.